Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
Live on Air, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Good evening and welcome. Nice to have your company for another edition of Live on Air, the Irish programme, and I hope you can stay with me until 7 o'clock. Now, coming up on today's programme, I am going to be playing part two of the documentary that we started last week. Today, part two, and the final part, indeed, of Boyer's Limerick. And I'll give you more information as I introduce that in the second part of the programme. Michael Dixon is a fascinating man, and he's going to be talking to me about Red Hugh O'Donnell. Do you remember, well, not Red Hugh really, but do you remember a couple of weeks ago Red Hugh O'Donnell's burial place was located in Valladolid? Now, people knew where it was. We spoke to Patricia Traynor all about this, so I won't go back on it. But anyway, it kind of re-emerged stories about Red Hugh and the man that is supposed to have poisoned him. Now, there's a difference in opinion as to how Red Hugh may have died back around 1600, but James Blake was the man that was blamed for a long time for having poisoned him. I'll be talking to Michael Dixon about James Blake and the possibility as to whether he did or didn't actually poison Hugh O'Donnell. And we'll be talking about information that's contained in a document that was written back in 1950. And this is the first time that it's been spoken about in public, so that's a really nice one. I'll be looking at the famous Irish birthdays as well. We'll have some good Irish music, including the number one on this very day back in 1972 in Ireland. Now, I did mention in the promos that you've been listening to over the last couple of days that I would talk to you about formation of government in Ireland, and I think I'm going to hold that over until next week because I'd like to get a little bit of reaction and analysis to the formation of the Irish government, the new government that was elected, a Fianna Gael, Fianna Fáil and Green Party coalition now governing Ireland. And I think we'll do something a little bit more in depth next week on the programme. So today I'm going to start with the birthdays as I normally do. And it's the 29th of June. It is so hard to believe that next week we'll already be into, well, in fact, in 2 days' time, we'll be into July. Devon Toner, the international rugby player, was born on this day back in 1986. Eric Rixom, the musician, used to play with Them and Thin Lizzy, born in Belfast in 1947. Verwyn Jones, broadcast journalist, born on this day in 1950. And Audrey Russell, radio commentator and war correspondent, was born in Dublin in 1906. Tomorrow, Tuesday, Sean Scully, the artist, born in Dublin, now based in New York. We did something about his works last year on the programme. Well, he was born on the 30th of June in 1945, so happy birthday tomorrow. Mary Manning, the novelist and playwright and critic, was born in Dublin on that day in 1905. On to Wednesday and into July, the first of the month. David Norris, senator and campaigner, born in 1944. Robert Stawell Ball, the astronomer, was born in Dublin on that day in 1840. And a man by the name of Sonny Condell, singer, songwriter and all-round entertainer, really, linked to Scullion and Tiernan Ogue and others, born in Newtown, Mount Kennedy in 1947. Thursday is the birth date of Katie Taylor, the boxer, born in Bray in 1986, and Pete Priquet, the musician from the Boontown Rats, born in Bally James Duff on that day, the 2nd of July 1954. To Friday, Shane Lynch, musician and singer, born in Dublin in 1976. And if you know your music and your Shane Lynch's, you'll know that he was part of the Boyzone group. Bridget Dowling, her claim to fame is that she was Hitler's sister-in-law. Yeah, Hitler's brother lived for many years in Dublin. I think was working in the Gresham Hotel there on O'Connell Street. Well, anyway, Bridget was born in Dublin in 1891. And Bernadette Greevey, the singer, Bernadette, well known to all Irish people, I would imagine, of a certain age anyway, certainly over 40. Born in 1940 on the 3rd of July. To next weekend we go. Saturday is the 4th of July. Thomas John Bernardo, philanthropist and founder of Homes for the Poor Children, was born in Dublin in 1845. You'll be familiar maybe with Bernardo's charity, still working to this day. Phil Hogan, politician and EU commissioner, born in Kilkenny on that day in 1960. John Stanislaus Joyce, the father of James Joyce, born in Dublin in 1849. And Darren Holden, musician and singer with the High Kings and other groups as well, born in 1972. And finally, we go to next Sunday, the 5th of July. Shane Phelan, the musician, singer and songwriter with Westlife, born in Sligo in 1979. And Veronica Guerin, journalist, born in Dublin in 1958 on that day. And you will recall that during the week, we marked the anniversary of her death. She died on the 26th of June in 1996. So there we go. Some famous Irish birthdays for you coming up this week. And usually we try and pick a musical birthday for that, for our first piece of music on the programme. And here's a band I haven't played in a while, but one-time member Eric Rixom. In fact, he still might be playing with them to this day, because they still are gigging. Unfortunately, they don't have their frontman, Phil Lynott, anymore. But Eric Rixom celebrates his birthday today, formerly with Thin Lizzy, born in Belfast in 1947. And here's the Lizzy.
Dear Miss Lonely Hearts, I had to write this letter to tell you how I came to meet her. She was sweet, but I dated her sister. That's how I made my mistake, and I can't forget her. I felt depressed till a friend of mine suggested that I write you this address. So unless you can find a cure for my loneliness, it will persist.
I've got
see, because Eric Rixom is celebrating his birthday today, born in Belfast on this day in 1947. And that's a great song called Dear Miss Lonely Hearts. Right, going to take a quick break. Come back to me just after that. And we will have the second part of Boyer's Limerick.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Welcome to the second part. Last week I played part two. I played part one of Boyer's Limerick. It was a day that I spent with Brendan Boyer, former lead singer with the Big Eight and the Royal Show Band. If you were listening last week, you will know that he spent formative years in Limerick. He came to Limerick from Waterford when he was about two and went back to Waterford about 14 or 15. Always held a great grow for the city. In other words, he had a great love for Limerick City and the people of Limerick, had great friends there. And even when he became famous with the Big Eight and the Royal Show Band, he returned to Limerick on a regular basis, and on one of those journeys back I spent a day with him and we walked the streets of Limerick in the rain and we visited places and people that were synonymous with his time in Limerick. And so we present to you part two of Boyer's Limerick.
In this, the second part of Boyer's Limerick, we meet more of Brendan's friends, hear more stories of his youth, and indeed his many visits to Limerick after he shot to fame with the Royal Show Band. We start with a reunion outside what used to be the Savoy, with Maureen O'Brien, who runs the O'Rourke School of Dancing. But she is also the daughter of Brendan's former teacher, Michael Toohey. The conversation starts with memories of the late Michael Toohey.
Coming in third and fourth.
Third and fourth, yes.
He did, yeah. And yeah, so we learned all those great songs from him as well. But I remember how patriotic he was as well.
Oh, he was. But, I mean, we all grew up with it, and my children have inherited that now, and I hope their children. It's the fourth generation up in the Moss School now. Mm-hmm. My grandchildren are up there. So,
very influential. He was terrific. He must have been awful young.
Yes, we were. I was.
Was he in his 40s when he died?
He was 40 when he died.
Yeah.
He was. So, cycled home from school, just back to the mother. Went in home to sit down, eat his dinner, and drop the knife.
My gosh.
That was it.
I remember he was, apart from, we spoke Irish all the time.
And
he was very patriotic.
Yes, oh, he was.
Which wasn't that long after 1916, too,
at
you know.
That time, 1951 he died. It's a lifetime ago, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But your father, yes. he had plays, remember, in the City Theatre and
he
everywhere.
Had,
yes.
He was an entrepreneur with no money. And left us.
Sure, nobody had any money.
Yeah,
then.
But he died without money. We still have money. But he left great memories. And my father came home once and he said, I got a great idea. I'm going to get Stanley Byers' son to sing Skibberee, and the Frawley's going to be his son's.
From the ocean, shining in the sun, covering the shore. When I see them, my heart tells me that I love you more than all the little pearly shells.
So we did like Skibbereen here with the O'Rourke School of Dancing. We're outside the Savoy now.
Yes.
Yeah.
And John Frawley, John the man, as he was beloved in Limerick.
Indeed, yeah.
And you were dressed as an old man.
I was.
And he had a cotton wool moustache. And we had a matinee and as well as the night show. You sang, my boy, I love my native land. With energy and pride.
That's it.
Yes, you sang that.
And John would have said to me, oh, Father dear, I often hear you speak of Erin's Isle.
John used to say it, say a lot of it on the radio, you know.
Mm.
And he used to say, I was Oliver to his Fagin. You were Fagin, he was Oliver. He was the small boy. They sang, oh, Father dear, and you'd say, my boy, I love my native land. With energy and pride. Mm. Till a blight came over all the land. My sheep and cattle died. My rates and taxes were to pay, then I could not redeem, and that's the cruel reason that I left those Skibbereen.
Go, Brendan Boyer. I dance and queue around down the cellar, and then outside and drunk keen of a Sunday night.
And maybe the
and the Majestic in Low Castle West.
Oh my God, yeah.
I didn't go to Mallow, it was too far, and the buses weren't going that time. You were out drunk keen of a Sunday night.
That's right.
You'd be out the jetting and they queued miles down the road.
I know.
The Davin is gone, the jetting is gone. But when the buyers sit there,
well, thank God.
You have rat fellas doing this and doing that. and they haven't tuned it on there. You went up on the stage, you had nothing, but you danced, and 2,000 people danced with you.
That's right.
And they never stood up once because you were too busy dancing and singing. I know, I have them all outside, I have all my LPs that height. And I have the old record player I bought over in Kansas, and I played with the two speakers. And the young man's now run up and said, Dad, what are you doing? I said, I'm playing men that know about music and women that know about music. I came from up the road. They came down for the windmill there.
Remember the survivors?
That's right. And your father came from McConnell Avenue.
He did.
No, that's great.
I know more about you than I say you know yourself.
No,
we're catching up today.
Let me know, Brenda.
When I was young, I used to wait on my master and give him his plate and pass the bottle when he got dry and brush away the blue-tail fly.
The Great Boer Lives features in one of Cormac Liddy's many stories about Brendan's visits to Limerick.
Well, one particular story concerns the Limerick Boat Club. We used to go down to the Limerick Boat Club, and there on a few occasions was Boer Lives, and Brendan and Boer Lives, you swap songs, and at the time you would have paid an awful lot of money to hear them individually, not to mind performing free in a small place like Limerick Boat Club.
And why was Boer Lives in the boat club?
Because he used to live in Palliskenry, and he used to like the quietness of the boat club, where they had
come in by river, no.
But a lot of us nearly went out by river.
But there were some political aspirations in there as well, were there?
Brendan and I used to meet in the old Brazen Head, and Donna Comali used to own it at the time, and it was a very colourful place. If I may just tell one story about Donna first. Peter Dempsey was a lovely musician. He used to play with Bud Clancy. But Donna came down in a foul mood from the Dáil one Friday night, and Peter was strumming his guitar right behind Donnock, who wheeled round and asked him how much was he being paid. Peter told him, and Donnock threw him 10 times that amount and told him, don't come back here for 10 so-and-so weeks. Needless to say, Peter was back the following weekend. But we were in there one night, and Donnock suggested to Brendan that he might stand for Fianna Fáil in Waterford. Now, whether Brendan has those tendencies or not at that time, like many others, he mightn't have them nowadays. But Donnock did ask him to become a candidate, isn't that right?
Yeah, actually, on my mother's side of the family, they were very much involved in the Fianna Fáil party in Waterford. So he probably might have had an inkling of that from some of the politicians down there. But he did, and actually, I met him on the top of the juries upstairs with Brian Lenehan and Neil Blaney years, not around the same time. And he just waved over after being with you. And so he introduced me to the boys. But Neil Blaney came to me up in Donegal and said, are you joining the party in Waterford now?
As a parting comment, Maureen O'Brien assures Brendan that he hasn't changed a bit.
God, you're looking the same as you always did.
Oh, God.
No, you are.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Maureen, really. Because
I've met Olive on the scene a few times.
Yeah.
Yes, she sings in weddings and shows and bonnetti and all that.
Yeah.
And some of the dancers corporate and...
Did you ever play in the Savoy?
We did a concert in 1975 for Tom Dunphy Memorial Concert, and we did a tour around the country, and it was this big theatre. But I didn't realise how big it was when we were doing it with the Old Rook School of Dancing, but it was huge.
Huge it was. And we used to love running around, and then your father would be complaining to them small ones are running down, watching the pipes and the colours. Mm. We'd be in the organ pit under at the back. We spent a lot of Sunday nights of our youth in there in the Savoy. Yeah. It was, and you know, when it closed, it was the end of an era for Limerick.
Of course it was, yeah.
Because they had, you know, the great stuff there. Martin Dempsey, they'd bring down Gloria Green, Austin Gaffney, Louis Studley. They were all, like, big names before RTE ever came on.
You're saying you're a number on, yeah?
Oh, very well. I was saying to Maureen, I remember she was wearing makeup and she was singing and dancing All Around My Hat. You know, all around my hat I wear a three-coloured ribbon. Oh, you know that. It was beautiful.
It was lovely.
Yeah.
And she used to sing him, Shall My Soul Pass Through Old Ireland for Kevin and Tomás McCurtain, the dead in hunger strike. You know, I can remember as well, you went away then, like, as soon as you went into secondary, you went to Waterford.
Yeah.
And that's great. That's just great to meet you now. I'll have to ask you about a girl Maureen Carter.
Oh, yes.
She was one of your very first Hucklebuck girls.
Well, she does, and she did the Irish dance.
Yeah, she was a great Irish dancer in London. She's from Galway.
And were these girls you had dancing specifically?
Well, Maureen, they were Maureen, doing Maureen the Hucklebuck. Maureen still lives in Las Vegas.
She does.
Yes.
They had very short red skirts and black tops and very black shiny hair, and they were very glamorous, but they were all talented dancers. Mm-hmm. You auditioned them. This one was a champion Irish dancer. She danced for the famous Ted Kavanagh, and then she was engaged to Richard Griffin. She went off with him, but then she preferred him and left Richard Griffin. I went off to Las Vegas.
Oh, gosh.
I remember that. I remember just all the talk in the Irish dancing circles. Did you hear Maureen Carter's gone off with Brendan Byer? It sounded like love, like it was a dancing, it was a dancing connection.
Oh, she's a great friend today.
Yes.
She grew up more of a, my wife is from Galway, so
yes.
they actually
had a connection. Yes.
Yeah, but they knew each other before.
Your
I
wife
knew.
Was one of the Brendans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Cecily was in my
wife. Cecily's her first cousin.
Yes.
The memories are lovely, but one of the biggest talking points in Limerick for years was Brendan's performance with the Royal Show Band at the opening of the Jetland in the early 1960s. Journalist Cormac Liddy again.
Well, first of all, there was a major court case prior to the opening of the ballroom, and Judge Barrow imposed a ceiling on the number of people who could attend. And I remember that on the night before Brendan came out and opened with Dadu Ron Ron, there were at least five times the number of permitted people in the ballroom, and it was one of the all-time great nights, one of many great nights, of course, at the Jetland, particularly the St. Stephen's night gigs. They were always jammed and packed, and Packy Hayes's Across the Road benefited greatly before, nice. During and after.
The Devon Arms.
What year was that?
63, I said.
63, yeah.
And have you any idea whose idea it was to bring Brendan Byer to Limerick for the opening of it?
Well, I presume T.J. Byrne arranged it with the then manager, the predecessor of Maxie Muldoon. He was a man
Cody.
With glasses. Cody,
John
yeah.
Cody,
John
yeah.
Cody, yeah.
And Brendan, what was it like coming back to Limerick?
We had been playing Drumkeen since 1959, and we had played the Stella, actually, in 1959. Oh. But the Stella never had the scope that the Jetland had, and the balconies and the space, so, and the parking, or for that matter, even though we didn't have cars, did we? Had too many of them.
And Our Lady had appeared at the Stella around about that time, and that tempted many people not to go in case there'd be another apparition.
What happened?
Our Lady was reported to have appeared in the ballroom.
During our visit to the model earlier in the day, we met Dennis Keogh, who was at the Jetland on that memorable night.
Oh, so we were there and we danced all night, that's all I could tell you, you know. All we went for was the women, I suppose.
And what about Brendan?
Yeah, he was real mega. All the youngsters were looking up to him.
Oh, were you big fan?
I was, yeah. Especially, Boulevard.
At Boulevard, when the sun was setting o'er the bright May meadows of Chevalier, a rebel hand set the heather blazing and brought the neighbors from far and near. Then Father Murphy from old Kilcormac spurred up the rock with a warning cry.
After the Jetland, Brendan would come out to my house, and there would have been a slight delay after the dance when he signed autographs and spoke to other people in other places. And he'd come out to my house and he'd take off on the piano. And the neighbours, instead of kicking up, would all come into the house. And we would have a session there until all hours of the morning. On another night, for some reason, I challenged Brendan to play table tennis. I couldn't see Brendan not to mind a small table tennis ball. And he, having wiped me on the table, he told me he had played table tennis for Munster.
Is that a true story?
I actually won the Irish Close Championship in John's Pavilion, of all places, really? Up next to the CBSC, you know, where it is on Mulgrave Street.
To what extent did his soccer achievements go?
Well, he was reputed to be so talented that the late Mr. Harry Gibson Steele once offered to sign him for Limerick as a goalkeeper.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think I was actually, they had it in the newspapers that I was signing.
And on another occasion, Brendan joined me at the Marcus Field for a cup game between Limerick and Waterford. And Limerick led early on, and a few minutes from the end, Waterford equalised, and Brendan gave a big jump and stuck his head in the roof of the press box at the Marcus Field, and that hole is still there. It was one of these plastic roofs, and he stuck his head.
Of course,
through.
They still have the dogs there, don't they?
Yeah, they still have the dogs there. For the moment, Brendan very, very kindly offered to open a hairdressing shop in O'Connell Street in Limerick. Now the traffic was stopped. Total mayhem. Hundreds turned out for the occasion, and unfortunately, while Brendan was upstairs, somebody broke the glass in the front window. And a few weeks later, instead of getting a letter of thank you, your man rang me to pay for the cost of the broken window. That was the thanks that Brendan got for trial. I think he came from Dundalk for it, but that was the thanks he got. Yet on another occasion, Brendan did a concert in the Crescent Hall for All Crescent Rugby Club, and he did loads of gigs for people who needed help at the time, and was very, very good with his time. And that, there was a famous night, I think it might have been after the All Crescent night, that he came to Cruces for some charity event where Bud Clancy, one of our finest musicians, was playing. And Brendan was called upon to do the Hucklebuck, and Bud had one version of the Hucklebuck, and Brendan had his own version. And after three drawn attempts, they called it quits, and the event was called off.
Brendan, just talking there with Cormac, just the friendships that you've built up down through the years, and the friends that you've made, and how important are the friendships here in Limerick?
It's a very part of my life that's very much imprinted. I mean, you remember the days, they were all lovely long summer days, we think now, you know. Of course, we were probably complaining about the rain then too. But yeah, in the model today, I was going through the pictures, and you know, people like Jackie Sasha down in, we were mentioned down in Joseph Street, and you know, we used to hang out a lot together, but I wonder where they are today, a lot of them. And I remember meeting Peter Barry up in Donegal not so long ago, and he used to live in Farnshone, I think.
Jackie Sasha is still very much alive, still around. He's retired as a manager of a credit union.
Okay.
I often bump into him, and he's always wondering how you are.
Frankie Carr and Aidan Carr lived across the road from me in Claverview Terrace. You know, we see Aidan and Cormac in at the Limerick Leader quite a lot. And, of course, Tom Tobin, of course, was a great friend, wasn't he? Because a Waterford man that was moved up here, like myself.
And who gave you your first gig, he always said?
He did down in Clonay, the sheep herders danced down in Clonay. Yeah. I think there were more sheep than people at it, but anyway.
All Limerick natives have probably swam, or maybe even like Brendan, learned to swim at the Corbally swimming baths. Brendan and his pals, like so many others, looked upon the baths at the end of the Mill Road in Corbally as the Riviera.
Well, she got her daddy's car and she's cruising to the hamburger stand now. Yeah, she forgot all about the library, but she told her old man now. And with the radio blasting, goes a-cruising just as fast as she can now.
The little bridges down there at the, when we came down the pathway from the end of the Mill Road, we used to swim there, and of course the bank on the far side we used to hang out on and to dry out or lie in the sun or whatever. And then, of course, after a couple of years later on, in the later 40s, they built the baths here.
You described to me that this was like the Riviera to ye.
Oh, it was. Unless you got to Kilkee or Ballybunion or Lahinch, you know, this was the only alternative. And it was, but it was very good, it was very safe. And, you know, gangs of kids every day during the summer down here swimming. And it was like the Riviera to us at that time. And as I said, the excitement when the baths came in. I learned to swim actually down there. I remember one time I just pushed off on my leg and I stayed up. And then was doing the dog's paddle. Oh, sorry. It's pouring rain as we're standing here. I'm sure we remember the long, hot summers, but I'm sure we swam in the rain here too. It was a kind of a resort area for the Limerick youth in those days. It was a day-long thing because it was a long walk from, say O'Connell Avenue and the Redemptorist down to here. And coming down the Mill Road with you this time, I suddenly realised even the Mill Road itself, the old Mill Road, how long it is.
And how built up it is, of course.
It is,
what would have been on the road from Corbally Road down to here? What would have been on the road in those times?
I'm sure there were some residences, some gated residences there, you know, that. But that's all. There wasn't any residential areas as such, but walls and fields and gardens. That's all I remember.
Well, it certainly has been a wonderful stroll through Boyer's Limerick. On behalf of all who have enjoyed Brendan's music over the years, a big thank you. And on behalf of the people of Limerick, for keeping in contact and for being proud of your Limerick roots, an extra special thank you. We'll always be proud of you. As we left the baths in Corbally, I was thinking to myself that maybe the best Limerick person to thank Brendan would be Limerick's first citizen. So we called upon Mayor John Gilligan and took a break from the rain. Mayor John Gilligan, on behalf of the people of Limerick, will finish off our trip down Memory Lane and through Boyer's Limerick.
Well, I must say that I'm delighted to have Brendan here. In fact, it's quite an honour. Brendan, like so many of people in my generation, was somebody, you know, who we, you know, really looked up to and held in high esteem. Most Limerick people would remember his father, particularly playing the organ down in the Savoy. And obviously his sister is married to Brian O'Brien. So Brendan, you're a native of Limerick too. Even if only I can make you an honorary one for the day, I'm sure you will understand. But I'm really very, very pleased and chuffed to have you here. You've been part and parcel of Limerick City for so many years. We all remember going to see you at the Jetland. We all remember, you know, the energy that you brought to your performances. And I'm delighted to see you after so many years in the sunshine. But it's great to have you here, Brendan. You're very, very welcome to the office of the Mayor.
My lady.
A fitting salute to Brendan Boyer from the then Mayor of Limerick. That concludes our documentary on Boyer's Limerick. Thank you to everybody who got in touch after last week after hearing the first part of it, so they were looking forward to the second part. People from Limerick who recognised names and voices and places. It was lovely to hear your memories for that. Thank you very much for getting in touch. And I hope that, there was other people as well that didn't come from Limerick or don't know Limerick too well, but got a great sense of the city and a different sense than what they would have normally got through the media of Limerick City, thanks to the documentary. And I hope that you enjoyed part two of that documentary with the late Brendan Boyer. Arreshte gorev anam. That is my lot for the second part of the programme. Let's take a quick break, come back to me after that. And in the third part, I'll be talking to Michael Dixon. I will also be playing the number one song in Ireland on this very day, back in 1972.
Live on Era, presented by Ger Sweeney.
Welcome back to the programme. You may recall a couple of weeks ago I spoke to Patricia Traynor, one of our regular contributors to the programme, about the discovery of the burial place of Red Hugh O'Donnell in a place that's called Via Dolid. And there was great excitement about that and hugely significant as well. And it is going to hopefully further help the relations between the Spanish and the Irish and maybe cross over with tourism and all sorts of things. Our Spanish-Irish cultural advisor is Jose Antonio Sierra, and he received a lovely note from a man called Michael Dixon. And basically, Michael said to him that the rediscovery of the burial place of Red Hugh O'Donnell is another physical reminder of the historic and centuries-old friendship between the Spanish and Irish people. There is a forgotten and scholarly article about another projected Spanish attempt to assist the Irish people back in 1602. Now, especially interesting about this is that the plan was drafted by a man called James Blake, sometimes named as the poisoner of Red Hugh O'Donnell. Another contemporary evidence indicates that Red Hugh died while being treated for an intestinal infection. And Blake's innocence is fortified by the intricate details of his invasion plan that indeed had every appearance of a successful conclusion if it had been implemented as Blake suggested. That is what Michael wrote. And he joins me right now via Zoom. Michael, it's very good to talk to you. How are you today?
And how are you, Ger?
I'm in top form.
Break up, but we'll hang along there.
Okay. If we need to move to the phone, we can do that. There's no problem. Michael, you wrote to Jose Antonio of the Clans of Ireland.
Basically, I'm director of correspondence at Clans of Ireland. We are a voluntary group under the auspices of the President of Ireland.
Okay.
We try to maintain the cultural aspects of our prior to, as we have it, civil registration. So anyone who was resident in Ireland prior to civil registration, which is 1864, is entitled to join Clans of Ireland, assuming they have a clan.
And how many clans are there?
It's usually somewhere in and around the 70 mark. We vary from year to year.
Okay.
We tend to attract, as you might imagine, an older segment of people, and older people tend to move on to a higher plane. Then the clan has got to be reformed, and we start again. Clan is a group of people, not less than six people.
Okay.
Who wish to show and exhibit their cultural heritage to ancient Ireland.
And does Clans of Ireland as an organization assist people with maybe tracing family or clans or helping them in some way? Or is it just you do the work and then you can join with us and whatever?
We are set up to register. We register the clan, i.e. we authenticate.
Okay.
The clan's right to be on the register. From a point of view of genealogy, as you know, and I sit in front of you as the third Michael, and in between us, there's a Cyril, my father.
Right.
My great-grandfather, Michael, started the family tree in 1898. My late father added more to the tree than the other two Michaels, but still, it's a project in progress.
Okay.
And that's the way genealogy should be. So can we afford to assist people? Really, no. Because as I say, it's a labor of love. It's your love for your own family. And who is best to do it? Professional genealogists can, of course, assist you.
Okay.
But you are your own family's best genealogist.
Right.
You know your older people. Go out there, talk to them before they die.
Right.
We have a saying, every time an old person dies, it's the equivalent of a whole library of knowledge burning down.
Yeah.
You must prevent that. You must save that knowledge.
Interesting. Are there many in the Dixon clan?
We have approximately 36.
Okay.
We are one of the smaller clans.
It's fascinating. I'm sure there's a lot more we could actually do on the Clans of Ireland. But I want to talk to you about Frederick Jones. Was he a priest? Was he a Father Jones?
Frederick, yeah. He was an eminent historian as well as, of course, a priest of long standing.
Okay.
He accumulated knowledge, and it's amazing. Now, this is where I talk about you saving your family tree. But in many, many ways, Jose is going to do the same for Frederick. He's going to save his knowledge that he produced in 1950. He's going to reproduce it in Spanish, and he's going to make it available for a Spanish audience to read about.
Lovely.
It's surprising, really. We have to reinvent ourselves and reinvent our history. Unfortunately, at very short intervals. Now, I mean, 1950 was not a very long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
That article seems to have been totally forgotten to the point of where an eminent historian in Ireland ran out the old canard about Blake being the poisoner of Red Hugh.
Okay. Can I just, for the listeners, can I just explain that Frederick Jones wrote in the Journal of the Galway Archaeological and Historical Society back in 1950 an article titled James Blake, A Projected Spanish Invasion of Galway 1602. So this is who Frederick Jones is. And this document goes back to 1950. Where has it been?
Lingering in tired, worn copies in libraries.
Right.
It hasn't been sourced or it hasn't been used, despite the fact he goes back to first sources. All of that article is based upon first source research. Not necessarily his. There was a priest who preceded him, which he mentions in the course of the article, who wrote in the Irish Ecclesiastical Record.
Many of these papers were found included in the Vatican Papers, which suggests that the battles at the time wasn't necessarily about oil. It was about Catholicism versus non-Catholicism. It also was to do with money, obviously. And the Vatican kept a very close eye on what happened in Little Ireland, didn't it?
The Vatican, when they were presented with the Flights of the Earls, which preceded the year before this, mm-hmm. this article is set, the Flights of the Earls arrived originally in Louvain, in nowadays Belgium, part then of the Spanish Empire.
Uh-huh.
And the Spanish Netherlands. And what happened was a rather strange thing for the church to do. They separated the children from their parents. The parents were moved rather swiftly to Rome.
Right.
Anywhere bar a close port in Spain where they might decide to revisit our. But their children were particularly well looked after. And I suppose as dynastic children, they were used to being separated from their parents and being educated separately. But it was still a strange thing for a church to do.
Mm-hmm.
The people themselves, I'm talking about the Flights of the Earls, the large group of people arrived over to the continent, over to Spain. And not only did Spain really not know what to do with them,
okay.
The other Catholic powers didn't know what to do with them. You can imagine relations between themselves and Britain was like a flux, was
yes.
like a tide, sometimes in and sometimes out. And
going back then to James Blake, the papers that you've sent show that up to about 1587, he was a trader. He was married. He had children. And then it all seemed to change in the aftermath of the Armada, with various ships being shipwrecked and you know, coming up on the coast. And that's when he really took on a whole new form. He managed to get himself ingratiated with one of the captains of the fleet. He got a letter of introduction to King Philip II in Spain from that. And then the whole thing just spiraled for him, didn't it?
Yes. Well, let's go back a stage, if you don't mind.
Okay.
And I'll introduce you better to James Blake.
Oh, great.
James Blake was, he came, first of all, from a very, very important group of people. They were called the Tribes of Galway, which sounds rather ridiculous nowadays.
Yeah, City of these the Tribes.
These were the princes, the merchant princes of Galway City. They had survived regime after regime. They had gone through changes in religion, in politics and everything else.
Okay.
They were a very, very powerful group of people. Now, he was one of the scions of that family. The Blakes.
Mm-hmm.
A predecessor of his had been the Lord Mayor of Galway City. His own brother, as far as I recall, Valentine, he was, I think, an alderman.
Okay.
So they weren't exactly your usual ragamuffin.
Okay.
They were very important people. James Blake, his career certainly began, as you say, with the foundering of the Armada on the coast of Ireland. Now, I'm second-guessing the whole thing.
Right.
He probably looked at the ships which were tumbling ashore and said to himself, and the people all drowning all around him, said to himself, what an awful waste. And as a result of the waste of people which had occurred and provisions and war equipment, he came up with this rather ingenious and intricate plan.
Huh.
If you want to prove that James Blake was not a poisoner, if you want to prove that he was not a charlatan, he was a spy for several countries.
He was, wasn't he? Yeah.
But still, he was an Irishman. Above all, he came up with this very intricate and very workable plan. And I think that the details in the plan are the confirmation that he was a patriot.
Yeah, he was able to demonstrate that his fabulous working knowledge of the rivers and the, you know, how to get into Galway City, how many ships could actually be docked safely there, what you could do, the level of defences that the British forces had there. So he had it all marked out there. Why didn't it happen? Was Philip III not interested?
He was dealing with the Duke of Lima, was it?
Yes, yes.
He was dealing with a person who was rather reserved and who probably wasn't the smartest coin in the purse.
Okay.
If I was sitting where the Duke had been and I was presented with this plan, I would have looked at, on the one side, this awful balance sheet of loss of treasure and of personnel in the 1588.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would have said to myself, well, this man is providing me with a plan, which seems to make an awful lot of sense. And I could, if you like, rebalance the issues with Britain.
Okay.
Now, think about the chronology of this. The plan is 1602. The following year, Queen Elizabeth dies.
Okay.
The last of the Tudors. Now, we have all been brought up with the idea that the British were a monolithic power who could not be shaken, who commanded the seas.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, when we analyse what happened during the Armada, it wasn't the British ships that destroyed the Armada. It was the weather.
Yeah.
It was a monumental failure. Now, let's return for a moment to James Blake. He provided, first of all, a port of refuge, Galway.
Yeah.
And as you say, he detailed the fortifications, the number of people in the houses.
Yeah, yeah.
Large numbers of which, as you know, Ger, would have been his relatives, quite happy to have fought for a relative who seemed to be doing the right thing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, compare his plan against, for example, Red Hugh. Red Hugh is justifiably a history's hero of Ireland. Whereas James Blake didn't provide a failed plan. You recall Red Hugh some years beforehand had ventured down to Galway with the O'Neills, and he destroyed not only Galway City, he robbed Galway City blind, basically.
Okay.
He literally burned down Athenry. Now, can you imagine an inhabitant in Galway? Can you imagine yourself being willing to ally with this person? I don't think so.
Right.
I don't think you would have had as much adherence to the causes of O'Donnell and O'Neill as you would have had to Blake.
Okay.
He was not offering you a grand challenge. He was going to give you a key to the kingdom. Why? We've seen in every invasion in history, every seaborne invasion in history, whether you're talking about Taranto, whether you're talking about D-Day, whether you're talking about Tarawa, the important thing is to get your troops on shore and establish your troops before the enemy attacks.
Yeah.
Your second priority is to have a sheltered bay so as you can get your troops' supplies ashore. Galway provided all of that.
It did, yeah. His willingness, and he, Blake said that he was on the way to Spain to poison O'Donnell. Was his dislike, we'll call it, of O'Donnell based around the fact that O'Donnell and the O'Neills basically pillaged and destroyed Galway and Athenry?
Precisely.
Okay.
He had made a previous offer to another man to poison.
That's right.
O'Donnell.
Mm.
As far as we can see, maybe he viewed O'Donnell as being not so much an assistance in the freedom of Ireland as an obstruction
okay.
to the relief and freedom of Ireland. The 1602 plan, at this point in time, we're talking about O'Donnell being dead. The plan would have gone into Operation 1603, which was, it was almost like God was on your side. No, that's a very overused phrase. It was almost like God was on your side. I mean, 1603, what was special about 1603? Queen Elizabeth I passed over, leaving behind a dynastic struggle. She and her father and siblings had created a Britain which terror stalked the streets. If you said a word out of turn, Ger, you're off to the chippy chop on the block.
That's right. But they would have been in a little bit of chaos and disarray at the time, and it would have been the perfect opportunity maybe for the Spanish to attack. Yeah.
For an attack. Think about it too. You know the geography. The where it's always paradoxically in the southwest,
mm-hmm.
because they could get their ships across to the southwest rather quickly.
Yeah.
So the preceding invasion of Kinsale not only was put in the hands of a military buffoon, you don't wait until the enemy attacks.
Okay.
You advance and attack the enemy.
Okay.
If you look at the Galway plan, the nearest that I know of, the nearest force that the British could command would have been from Athlone. Plenty of time to have drawn down from the Joyces, etc., up in Connemara.
Uh-huh.
You became a magnet for revolution.
In your opinion, James Blake, was he a good guy?
No. Would you have trusted any of these people?
How did James Blake die?
We don't know.
All right.
Last scene, he was in a Spanish jail, would you believe? He got to know jails quite well.
He did, yeah.
He escaped from jails quite quickly as well.
Mm-hmm. Being in jail in Britain and being in jail in Ireland would have been because of the fight against the English. And do we know why he ended up in jail in Spain?
We don't.
Okay.
We actually don't know. I dare say the answer lies down in Spain. That's a challenge for our Spanish-Irish contingent to chase. We have one witness as to his capabilities. At one point in time, he ended up incarcerated in Ireland. In one occasion, he was put into the dungeon in Dublin Castle with a priest hunter. You better explain to your audience what a priest hunter might be.
Well, were these the men that were working for the crown and were rounding up the priests and killing them as they found them?
I would describe them as bounty hunters.
Okay.
The more celebrated the cleric, the more you were paid.
Okay.
They were the most despicable form of life. Their idea was to insert themselves into a local community and discover if there was a priest there and to basically add his ears to their bracelet.
Wow.
This priest hunter tells us he was a very intelligent man who could converse in different language, who was quite at home on the continent. This was the first of the cosmopolitan travellers from Ireland. He didn't have to have a sword. Now, you and I both know that the Irish swordsman cut his way across the continent into the favour of the Catholic powers. But this man didn't require to use a sword. He simply used his wits and his intelligence, generally. His ability to be able to make himself one of the people who stood out.
Yeah.
Someone you could go to and respect.
All right. It's been fascinating listening to the story that we know. And that's only a very short little snapshot of the life of James Blake. An interesting character. I presume there's a lot more material available online or in libraries on him, is there?
There would be some material available, but you would have to go to first sources.
Okay.
You would have to go to the archival sources. He's a fascinating character.
Yeah. Well, Michael Dixon from Clans of Ireland, I really do appreciate you getting in touch with José Antonio Sierra. I appreciate the time you've taken today to talk to us about James Blake. We don't know whether he did or he didn't kill Red Hugh. He's an interesting character to look at anyway.
Imagine he did. I'd say that honour rests to the doctor who was treating for an infestation of parasite.
That seems to be the general consensus these days, isn't it?
That is the general.
All right.
Even at the Spanish authorities.
Michael, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. It's been fascinating.
Right, Jim.
I want to tell you, I might as well. She's got a brother like any other, who got his nose caught inside a gate. And when they freed him, it so relieved him, he just went ooh-wack-a-doo-wack-a-day. You wouldn't think to look at me that I was strong, but underneath it all I really am. And just to prove it, why only the other day I picked a needle up with one hand. Woo! Now up in Bradford, a chap named Radford, while taking part in a local play, was intercepted and then suspected of going ooh-wack-a-doo-wack-a-day. I saw you with, it was not your wife. It looked to me suspiciously like someone I have never seen before in my life.
Gilbert O'Sullivan and a song that's called Ooh Wackadoo Wackaday. It was number one in Ireland on this very day back in 1972. And if you can remember it, well, fair play to you. You must be doing well. I can't, because I would have been all of the age of five at that stage. It's almost time to say goodbye to you. Before I go, can I say that Jerry Daly, Father Jerry Daly, was in touch with the reception earlier on here at the radio station. Not today, but earlier in the week, to tell us that Mass has restarted. So if you are a Catholic and would like to attend a Catholic ceremony, the Catholic Church in Arroyo de la Miel is back in operation. And if you'd like to contact Father Daly for information on Mass times, well, you can do so on 697-896 697-896-198. All right, that's 697-896-198. Thank you to Father Jerry for letting us know about that. And I know that he celebrated Mass there yesterday at 1:30 and it was well received and well attended as well. Thanks as always to our Spanish-Irish advisor, that's Jose Antonio Sierra. It was through his work that we managed to bring Michael Dixon on the programme today. Thanks to Michael for joining us as well. Look after yourselves in the coming week. I look forward to being back with you next Monday for another edition of Live on Era. I hope you've enjoyed today's, and if you have, you might spread the word. Until next Monday, from me, Ger Sweeney. Bye-bye and thank you for listening.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.